Welcome back to the All That Podcast. This is episode 57. Today, unfortunately, this is my second show in a row where my co-host is not with me. She had some family scares this past week, so she is still, you know, trying to recover as far as, you know, her mind state. And also, you know, it's very exhausting having to work and worry about somebody you love being in the hospital. So if you will, please send your well wishes and prayers to Kelly and her family. I miss her. I hope she's back next week, because I'm pretty sure you guys miss her too. But so today we will be talking about a very reoccurring topic, which is HBCUs versus PWIs. For those of you who don't know what those acronyms mean, they mean HBCU means a historically black college or university. PWI means predominantly white institutions. So, you know, all over Twitter and social media, it's this back and forth bickering which one is best, you know, for students to go to. And I also was watching this podcast, another podcast. Man, the name of it is leaving me right now. But it's with some ex-NFL players, Brandon Marshall, Freddie Jackson, Reggie Wayne, and Fred Taylor, Reggie Wayne. So they were discussing, should, you know, all these black athletes go to HBCUs instead of going to PWIs, where they might not be accepted, or, you know, people making money off of their backs that don't really care about them. So that was the conversation. I was like, that's interesting. So later on, we will be having two of my friends, who one went to a PWI at Texas State, and another one went to an HBCU, Jackson State, and they will be on to discuss their views on the topic. All right, so first, we have our positive news segment, because Lord knows that we need some positive news with everything going on. Every week is something else. And it was the building blowing up in Lebanon, and I just saw today some volcano erupted somewhere. Do you know where it is? Where's the volcano? It was a volcano. Yeah, they had an explosion in Baltimore, a volcano somewhere else. I'm like, goodness gracious. So here's some positive news. So this teen that was abandoned at birth raised money to give senior dogs the love she found with a forever home. So the story reads, and this is courtesy of Good News Network. It says, abandoned in a basket on a college campus in India as an infant, Meena Kumar knows what it's like to need a little love. That's why she's drawn to the pups that are most often overlooked, senior dogs living out their golden years in animal shelters. Snuggling with four-legged seniors became her passion, and that dedication is helping to support second chances for dozens of dogs, even after being told she was too young to volunteer. More people should adopt senior dogs, she told CNN. They give you the same unconditional love as any other dog. The 14-year-old's love for canines began when she was no taller than a schnauzer. She spent a year in an Indian orphanage before adopted by a couple in Mumbai. As a 2-year-old, she lovingly spent hours caring for newborn pups in her family's apartment. My parents were worried about how to keep me amused in a small place, she told Today. Thankfully, a dog had laid a litter of puppies, and I used to spend hours every day watching and playing with them. Kumar's doggy dedication continued when she was brought to San Jose, California, where she insisted that family make regular visits to the Humane Society. When she was 8, they adopted Bambi, a mixed breed pooch. She spent hours training to do tricks. 2 years ago, as she was walking Bambi, she met a neighbor who had adopted through Muttville Senior Dog Rescue. She told Kumar about the nonprofit's cage-free rescue operation that gives senior dogs a second chance at life. The organization rescues about 1,000 dogs per year and runs mostly through the help of volunteers. I know what it feels like to be left behind, Kumar thought. The dogs may be senior and old, but they're so friendly and cute. They're the most gentle and loyal creatures. She enjoyed visiting the aging dogs at the rescue, but because she was 12 at the time, Kumar was 5 years too young to volunteer. The zealous girl wouldn't let ageist rules stop her. She decided to raise money for them instead, because you're never too young to start a business, she said with a smile. She launched a pet sitting business called Pet Fairy Services, and it took off. With rates at $35 per day, Kumar raised an impressive $7,000 in 2 years, and she donated it all to Muttville. A matching grant through Intel, where her dad works, meant her donation ended up topping $14,000. Even though the coronavirus pandemic has slowed things down for many nonprofits, the popularity of fostering and adopting dogs has skyrocketed. It feels great to know that I've saved many dogs' lives and given them another chance to enjoy life for their last years of living, she told Today. I feel like all dogs should get a forever home just like I did. I thought that was a very cool story. I know Kelly loved that story because she loves dogs. Like, she's an animal person. She loves dogs. So that was for you, Kelly, too. But it's kind of like what they say about, in a way, turning your mess into your message. And that's exactly kind of what she did. And those feelings of, you know, being left out and all that that she felt, she transformed that. Instead of letting that, you know, hold her back, she transformed that into something powerful and something positive. So shouts out to her. And that is the positive news for this week. So let's get into some hot topics. For all of my TikTokers out there, your time may be coming to an end. So President Trump said that TikTok, the owners of TikTok, had about 45 days to find an American company to take over them. So, yeah, many TikTokers are not happy about this at all because a lot of them make their money off of this and he's trying to take it away. My thing is, we have so much going on right now. Like, why is TikTok, why is that the lead thing that we're tackling? People are dying every day from the pandemic. People are out of work. Just the other day, 1 million people signed up for unemployment. And this is like months into the pandemic. And yet our focus is on TikTok. So, you know what I think, though? Here's my conspiracy. I think that Trump wants to ban TikTok because of the empty seats in Tulsa. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, remember back when Trump had that rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, right? He had that rally and he was going to do it on Juneteenth, right? Which people were mad about because, okay, Tulsa, Oklahoma was where Black Wall Street was. That was bombed, and Juneteenth is celebrating the freedom of slavery, and it's like, really, you're going to do that on Juneteenth? So people are upset. So these teenage TikTokers got people together to buy these tickets, right, to his rally, and they made him think they were sold out, right? So I could just picture Trump, like, this is going to be so big. Tulsa's never done anything like this. You know, it's going to be sold out. So he's pumped up. I know he was. And when he got there, half of the venue was empty. So to me, in my opinion, this is payback for that. Trump has not forgotten that. And so he's like, I'm going to come at TikTok with everything I have for them making me look foolish. But yeah, maybe on the flip side, this will push people to go vote. So if you're a TikToker, because I looked up the statistics, when you think of TikToks, you think of TikTok, you think of young people, but that's only under 18 is only about 30% of their users. So that means people who can vote are using TikTok in the majority. So maybe that'll get people to vote. So if you are upset about Trump taking away your TikTok, go to the polls. So, in other news, which is kind of related to Trump too, Michelle Obama on her podcast said that she thinks she was suffering from low-grade depression. And the reasons being is due to the pandemic, race relations in the United States, and political strife. So when she said this, I think that every American can relate to this because every day, like I said at the beginning, every day is something new. Like, for instance, my friend and my co-host Kelly was going through something this past week that was, you know, she was very emotional because of what was going on. And families are going through this every single day. You have families going through other family members getting sick. You have family members dealing with people losing their jobs. Right? You turn on the news, you're seeing one or two things you're going to see on the news. three things, actually. You'll see something about the coronavirus. You'll see and how many people are dying as a result of it, which is gives you anxiety and makes you a little sad. Or you'll see President Trump doing his, you know, Trump, you know, you'll see that, which will, you know, and then you will see something about racial tensions, right? So myself, when the whole George Floyd thing went on, I was so emotional during that time because all you would see on TV was that. You would see different things on social media bringing up, you know, the history of racism, and it's a lot. It's a lot. And I can only imagine how his family felt, or families who are in that position feels, because me, I'm so removed from the situation in a lot of ways, but I still felt emotional about that, because a lot of it is like, that could have been me. You know, a lot of it is like, are we still this far back as a people? A lot of it is good emotions in some ways, because you see all these people galvanizing around each other for a common cause. But it's a very like roller coaster of emotions that we have to go through right now, because it seems like there's never any good news. The day you think you're going to, you know, be all right, like, okay, today, maybe, you know, I can. No, you can't, because today, oh, this building blew up and killed all these people in Lebanon. Or, okay, then the next day you wake up like, okay, maybe, you know, this building blew up in Baltimore is like kill some other people. Every single day. So when Michelle Obama said that, when I heard she said that, I was like, I can definitely relate. And a lot of us probably don't even know. She called it low-grade depression. And it is, in a way. But I know a lot of people probably don't verbalize it like that. They just think like, oh, man, you know, it's never ending. But the reality is we probably have a whole nation of people who are going through some level of depression. And, I would totally agree with the former first lady on that. And hey, if you feel like this is too much, you're going through anxiety, you feel depressed, go see somebody. Okay. After this video, hit me. You can DM me on my Instagram. You can leave a comment or anything. I have therapists that are friends. If you need help, please reach out. And we will find somebody to help you. So Ellen DeGeneres is another person who's probably dealing with some depression of her own these days, because things just are not good for Ellen right now, right? She had a good run for like 20 years, but now things are like, So there have been many media reports alleging a culture of harassment and bullying and even some racism at Ellen's talk show. So a lot of us who grew up or watching Ellen or even knowing of Ellen always had this view of her as this woman with this big personality, always giving things away on her show, always dancing, always seeming to have a good time. That's the picture that most people have of Ellen. So when these people came out with these reports, you had her ex-bodyguard saying she was very cold to him. You have this guy who was on a TV show with her in Australia saying that, you know, her team told him not to touch her, don't look at her, anything. And then there is a comedian that said a similar thing. Let me see if I have his name. I don't know if I do. But it had a comedian saying a similar thing about Ellen. And so you're like, man, like, okay. At that point, a lot of people still wasn't believing it. They were like, okay, maybe these are just isolated incidents, you know. So when the staff of the Ellen show came out and with these reports, then people started to look at it a little more seriously. Like, okay, maybe Ellen wasn't the woman that we thought she was. So this past week, a lot of her celebrity friends, Kevin Hart, Jay Leno, all these celebrities are coming out and saying that Ellen was nothing but nice to them, that Ellen they know would never do anything like this, and et cetera, et cetera. So my question to those celebrities are, why would she be mean to you when she needs you to be a guest on her show? Why would she be mean to you or cold to you when you're at the same quote-unquote level or status as she is? That's not the problem. And actually, the celebrities coming out to defend, I'm sure Harvey Weinstein was a very nice person to other rich men that he was around. But does that mean that he didn't do those things to those women? No, it does not. And I'm not putting what Ellen did or allegedly did on the same level of what Harvey Weinstein was alleged of. But it's the same principle. You know, just because they were nice to these people, that doesn't mean that they couldn't be mean to people that they would view, quote unquote, as less as them. And some people are saying that, you know, Ellen, she didn't know. Like, you know, that was she. No, you know, when it's that is that kind of culture at your show, you heard something about it. Something got back to you. And if it didn't, that's still bad on your part that you wouldn't know what's going on in your operation. I think that the celebrities coming out to defend Ellen is not good, and it hurts her even more because it's contributing even more to what people see as tone deafness from celebrities. Like, you're so removed from things that you can't even see what regular people see. So they're deflecting away from what she was accused of. They didn't say that she was a mean person to her guest. They described sexual harassment by the top producers, racism against a black staffer, and generally abusive workplace. That were the complaints. The complaints were in that I was an asshole to Kevin Hart. That was not the complaint. So it's kind of deflecting away from what these people are alleging in their feelings about how they were treated on her show. So I think the celebrities probably should shut up on this one, to be honest with you. I think because they're not helping her case or their case in that matter, because it just put yourself in the position of those staff workers, and you are generally coming out with concerns about your workplace, what you experience, and then to have a celebrity who has all this power and affluence and money, and you know, for them to come out and say, "Oh, Ellen was great to me." So in other words, to the staff members that had those complaints, when Kevin Hart or whoever else came out and said that was like, "Oh, they're lying. Ellen is great." You know, that's how it came off, and I think that was very tone deaf. I think we need Ellen to come out and own her mess at the end of the day. No more PR statements. No more calling your celebrity friends. "Hey, man, can you get on Instagram? You know, tell, you know, that one time, you know, you came over to the house." No, we don't need any more of that. We need her to come out and own her mess. Say that either she didn't care about what was going on with her staff, or that she wasn't in control of her show as much as she should have been. So I think everybody will respect her more if she just comes out and be truthful. Like, the public, we can sort through BS. Like, you stop with the PR statement, stop with all this celebrity coming to your defense. No, just come out on your mess and you'll move on. So, all right, it's time to bring on my guest, guys. So coming up, HBCU versus PWI. All right, so now I have my two friends on the line. They don't want to get in a battle with each other, unfortunately, guys. So it'll be a nice PC conversation. Sorry. I was expecting something more more heated. But so I have Taylor Hurd, who graduated from a PWI, Texas State. She is a dean of instruction at a charter school in Texas in history. She graduated cum laude, Bachelor of Arts in English, minor in psychology, and she is currently pursuing a master's degree in education to principal, right? Principal, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. That's right. All right. And I also have Jordan Williams on the line. She has a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling and has a provisional license to counsel. And also, she is a national certified counselor. So obviously, I have some big timers on the podcast with me today. So say hello to the people, guys.
Hey, y'all.
Hey, guys.
All right. So this conversation that we're having today pops up, you know, every 6 months on Twitter. So I decided to talk about it today because I was watching a podcast, and they were actually talking about athletes taking their talents to HBCUs instead of going to PWIs. And I was having a conversation with my cousins about it, and I was saying that, because they were saying, are you going to push your kids to go to an HBCU? I said, I'm not necessarily going to make my child go anywhere that they don't want to go, but they will have all the information that they need about an HBCU. So I wanted to have that conversation with two intelligent young ladies who graduated from both. One complaint, if you will, about PWIs is this under representation and a sense of belonging. So I went to the University of Texas, San Antonio, and I can see the segregation for sure. So, you know, the black kids would hang out in one hall with each other. you know, it was very segregated. We had our own little homecoming separate from the rest of the homecoming at the school. And everywhere, you know, your professors were white for the most part. Dean was white, everybody white. So it's that argument that seeing yourself is important. Taylor, I want to get your experience going to a PWI. How did you internalize that, and what was your view?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to remember, I was coming from Katy, mm-hmm. which was predominantly white anyway, so I was used to being in environments like that where I was like one of few black people. And for me personally, I don't see those things as negative as far as like people finding their own people, because that's what I was forced to do, was find my own people. And it forced me to come out of my shell and join different orgs and things like that. I've made lifelong friends from those organizations. And it made me navigate my college life with intention, right? And be intentional about, you know, building, you know, a network there, because I had to find my people, you know? And again, I could see the criticism, and but for me, it wasn't a negative aspect. It was something that I found beneficial, to be honest.
Right. So, Jordan, you moved around a lot during growing up, but you did graduate and go to high school at a very, very, very predominantly white high school. And so, how was that going from Cinco to Jackson State?
You know, I did not want to go to HBCU, coming from going to a predominantly white school.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to go to a HBCU. I wanted to go to LSU. And that's because that's what I was comfortable with, and that's what I had been around for so long. So I wanted to follow my friends and do what I thought at the time was what I wanted. But my parents actually made me go to an HBCU, and I thanked them for that, because I found some, you know how Taylor was just talking about, she had to find her people.
Right.
And it's like, I was experiencing that at Cinco too, like having to find my people or having to figure out where I belong in a place where I felt so uncomfortable, but I'm here, so I still want to be accepted. So I'm trying to navigate that. And then I go to an HBCU on behalf of my parents, mm-hmm. and I'm at home. Like, I didn't have to find anybody. You know what I mean? It was just love. Like,
right.
I didn't have to be anybody else but me. And then I came to realize that I didn't even know who that was, because I had been around so many people who weren't like me. So my college experience was getting to know who I was as a black woman, not just as mm-hmm. a person who's going to school. So that's where the HBCU experience for me kind of differs, because I get exactly what you're saying, coming from a predominantly white area and then going to another white area.
Mm-hmm.
It comes with a lot of things, networking. It comes with education. It comes with money. It comes with a idea that I have to be something, which motivated me in my career field, and I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't give me who I am, you know? And
right.
I think that who I am is more important than my career field. And pretty much kind of sums up my HBCU experience.
Got it. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. kind of piggybacking off of that, talking about motivation, how was it for you being around other people that look like you, where success was like the standard in a way. Like you had all these successful black people around you. Your professors were black. You know, your grandfather was like, you know, running the school pretty much. And to have all that around you, what did that do for your motivation, your self-esteem, all that? What did that do for you?
See, what I'm going to let you know about HBCU is, yes, we have all of these amazing people who are great and leaders and are going to do great things. And I thank God that I was around those amazing black people since birth. But the HBCU experience is more of, honestly, I learned how to be me. I got all that education, all the things that I got, the fundamentals from the PWI. I'm going to say that that's what you get from them. But when I went to the HBCU, my teachers really weren't looking for me to be top thinkers. Like, they were teaching me how to survive in the world. You know what I mean? So it's like what I was learning from them wasn't about books, to be honest. It wasn't about how to write the paper in the correct format. And I was so used to that being what school was that I came in thinking I have to have all my education, all of this. And I was getting all the good grades, but socially and spiritually, I wasn't striving. So I started focusing on those aspects of my life.
Got it. Now, not that you...
due to the people who were around me.
Right. Taylor, not that you feel this way personally, but have you ever been around or felt the sense that black kids that go to PWIs feel the superiority over blacks that chose to go to HBCUs?
You know what? It's funny. I've seen it both ways, actually, Kyrie. I've seen people side-eye me, you know, in my teacher network that, oh my God, you didn't go to HBCU? What? Like, and I think there's room for elitists on both sides, to be honest. If you have someone that comes from one of those black Ivy League schools, right, like the Spelmans and the Howard, my God, you know, they are definitely, you know, ready to tell you where you went wrong in picking your college, right? But on the flip side, we have one of those, you know, us living in Texas, you got the big UTs and the A&M, you know, alumni that's like, oh, my God, you know, we are superior, you know, people that went to Rice and things like that. So I've experienced on both sides. I will say Jordan's point earlier, I kind of had the opposite type of mindset with, like, I wasn't chasing experience initially. I wanted education, right? I wanted, like, the practical skills. Looking back, I probably would have changed my thinking. Maybe not my decision, because I love Texas State. I love everything about my school. But maybe I would have had a different reason why I chose Texas State rather than just, like, hey, I want to pick this school because, you know, it's better for what I want to go into, you know?
Right. So Jordan was saying at the beginning that initially she wanted to go to a PWI. Did you ever have a want to go to an HBCU at all?
I did, but it wasn't because it was an HBCU. I wanted to go to Howard because I wanted to get into law. It had nothing to do with the fact that it was HBCU. I'm sorry to disappoint anyone. And honestly, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. I don't want anybody judging.
Go ahead. I need the juice. Upbringing. I'm just playing. I'm just kidding.
But I'm going to just tell it like it is. My mom kind of told me, listen, if you're not going to one of these black Ivy League type, HBCUs, you need to avoid them because they're going to set you up to fail. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And she was like, you're going to live in a fantasy world for 4 years about the work environment that you're coming back home to, and that's not how it is. And I want you to be able to navigate and move with people who don't look like you and be comfortable with that, too. And so now she will admit that maybe her...
Taylor? Jordan, are you still online?
The professional world once I exited college, you know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah, you went out for a little while, but... Yeah, that's actually a question I was going to ask that about kind of what your mom said about HBCUs.
You
went off. Huh?
Yeah, I missed all of that.
We didn't hear any of that.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. No, I was just going to piggyback off of what Taylor was saying about what your mom said about some HBCUs setting you up for failure because it's not a true reflection of your workplace. So I wanted to ask Jordan, what does she think about that argument that, you know, the world is not a black utopia, and so you need to be around a mixed group?
I really think that that's a hard question to answer, because the world is not a, the world isn't a black utopia.
Mm-hmm.
But why is it that the world is set up that I have to change who I am in order to fit into whatever box this is?
Right.
And at one point, I wanted to be in that box.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people do, because that's the norm of society. That's what is portrayed to us as what we should want in media, and mm-hmm. that's just what is given to us as that should be our goal.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, mm-hmm. as a human being, yes, I want to be within that box at one point. But now that I'm living in this world, that's not. And that's another thing. I was living in a PWI type of setting. Mm-hmm. And then I came to an HBCU setting, and I seen that the disadvantages for these people are not their fault. Yep. And it's like, has nothing to do with who they are as a people. Like, the things that mm-hmm. that people, that white people see as the difference between them and the other cultures has nothing to do with their culture. So they don't see the people. They see the poverty or the education level. And it's just like, I got tired of having to fit in that box and try to be the opposite of everything I wanted to be just to make other people happy. And mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense, but it kind of isn't important to me about how I'm supposed to look to this white man or to this company, because mm-hmm, I mm-hmm. have to die as Jordan.
Right.
So, mm-hmm, and I mm-hmm. learned that where I went to school, but I do get it trying to excel in that world. Cause I've been in that corporate world. I've worked jobs. I worked office jobs. I worked and got the license and got the degree and got the ability to counsel and do all this stuff. And mm-hmm. then I had to realize, am I happy with me? Past mm-hmm. all the, am I fit in this box of the world? But if you are trying to excel, take that route. It's just that people have different journeys, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we as a people are used to having to code switch anyway. So whether you went to an HBCU or not, you still have to get used to being in these spaces, because that's just the world, you know, that we live in.
And that's mm-hmm. not fair.
Mm-hmm. It's not. It's not at all.
No, definitely. It's nothing not fair.
No.
But you have to sometimes deal with that if you want a better quality of life, which is kind of a messed up way of thinking, but that's what comes with it. If you want the big, the nice house, the good neighborhood, the good education, you have to code switch.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to be comfortable with your people, don't code switch and go be with your people. It's mm-hmm. fucked up, but it's what we're left with as
right.
black people.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take this into consideration, so you're taking all this information in, you know, Taylor's your experience at PWI, Jordan, your experience at HBCU, and then you look at the data and you look at all the quote unquote major jobs or whatever professions, and you look at the stats that say that overwhelmingly the majority of black people who are quote unquote successful do come from HBCUs. So when you take all this into consideration and you're having a conversation with your child, are you pushing mm-hmm. them to go to an HBCU more than a PWI? Taylor, I'll start with you.
Absolutely not. I'm not going to push my child to go anywhere or do anything, because I'm someone that comes from a family. I'm the first one in my family to have a degree, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that education is not, you know, meaningful. Everybody was happy that I did it, but both of my parents are successful, but neither one of them hold degrees. So if my kid wants entrepreneurship as their, you know, adult trade, I'm not going to push college on them, you know. But I do want my children to make informed decisions, right?
Right.
If we're going to just keep it funky, every HBCU is not, you know, the same as far as accreditation, as far as, you know, their academic programming and all of that. So I'm not going to just paint this fantasy world. Like,
right.
if you're at HBCU, it's going to be absolutely great. No, I'm sorry. I'm going to tell you the best HBCUs to attend, just mm-hmm. like I would tell you the best PWIs to attend, and let you make your own choices, and let my child pick whatever is best for their educational pursuit.
Jordan?
at one point in time, I would have been like, my child can pick whatever he wants, but now Jackson State runs through my blood, and it's going to run through my children's blood, and Jackson State University is home.
Yeah.
So you have options if you get a scholarship, son, but if I'm paying for it, you're going to Jackson State,
yeah.
and you're going to absorb all that in and be great, and just, my child's going to Jackson State.
Which is not a problem,
because
though.
I know.
That's not a problem, because people do that all the time with their alumni. Like, they want their kids to go to the same school they went to, so that's not an issue.
Yeah, that's the norm. I mean, you look at the Aggie babies, look at the Longhorn babies. Like,
mm-hmm.
That is a thing, you know, to keep that going.
It's a culture.
Right.
And I didn't know it was a culture, you know?
Yeah, and parents be hurt if their kid go somewhere else other than their alma mater. They get hurt.
Oh, but don't play at something else. Lord.
Jordan, did you have any white kids go to your school?
Yes. We have all kinds of kids. Asian, Mexican.
So
everything.
That's another interesting podcast I should do. But from the outside looking in, how do you think that they fit in, or their experience? What did you see?
They were me at Cinco Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And that you bond with your clique, and you have a couple who would cipher out because of organizations or things that they did, or because of classes that they took. But for the most part, you know, you kind of stay with your group. But HBCUs are relatively small, so everybody knows everybody.
Right.
You know, it's a real community. It's a family. Like, I'll have people who I've never seen before. You know what I mean? Any type of a white woman. And just because me and her took a class together, I'll speak to her like a sister.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of how it was. Like, they had their own group, but they still assimilated with everybody else just because we were all there together anyway.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
One group of people that I think about when it comes to HBCUs is our mixed kids, because you come in with these two different worlds, and you already have to go through not either being black enough, or you too white, or you too black, or, you know, you got to go through all this. And so to go to an HBCU, there might be some, you know, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, identity crisis. Like, you don't know what's going on. Were you around any mixed kids at Jackson?
There were quite a few mixed kids, but the mixed kids that were there were pretty confident in that they kind of picked the black side.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then that's just who they were. And I feel like you also kind of, you become a part of who you're around. Like, I was not this Southern when I went to Cinco Ranch High School. But now I'm very Southern.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like, you learn from being who you're around. And they were around black people, so those mixed kids just kind of chose to be black.
Right. Adapted to their environment.
For the most part.
Yeah. So a lot of athletes, especially post-George Floyd, chose to take their talents to HBCUs. For a lot of different reasons, because one, at some of their universities, they feel like, you know, undervalued, or they found out their coach did something racist back in the day. It's a plethora of reasons why this came to be. And so when you think about one of the reasons that, you know, because we have to do a little history lesson here. The only reason HBCUs were created in the first place was because black people couldn't go to school with white people. Okay. So when you think about that, and think about the reason that black kids are even at PWIs right now, a big part of that is due to athletic programming. So when you're thinking from the athlete's perspective, and now there's so much money brought in and all these colleges, and UT makes $60 million a year from their athletic program, not even athletic program, from football alone. And a majority of those players are black. So, Taylor, do you Well, how do you, what do you think about the athletes deciding, some of these top athletes, recruited athletes deciding to go to HBCUs over a PWI?
Ooh, okay. The best way I can answer this question is I have to separate my head and my heart.
Okay.
My heart says that's beautiful. You know, I wish they all would do that and pour some more love and attention towards HBCUs and things like that. My head says if this is his kid's bread and butter, that's a risk. If they are really trying to pursue getting, you know, going professional and things like that, it's not going to end well. And I'm not saying that that's right. I'm not saying that that's how it should be. Mm-hmm. But it's not just one athlete that's going to change the system, right? It would have to take a full overturning of the system of all of the athletes that are superstars.
Oh, for sure. All the top recruits have to go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they would have to purposely choose HBCUs and force scouts to turn their attention to there, because right now they're not. They're looking at the big boys right now.
Right.
And they always have.
Jordan, being around obviously in HBCU's athletic program, what was your viewpoint on that? Like, did you see like it was underfunded? It wasn't obviously not as what's the word I'm looking for? As funded as, you know, like a UT, for example. So can you talk to the struggles of an HBCU athletic program that you saw?
I believe that the struggles from the athletic program is just the struggles of a HBCU overall.
Across
like,
the board, yeah.
HBCUs are going to get the lesser than. And we can take this back to even just Black communities, period.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get the lesser than. And that's how the money flows, regardless of how we look at it. So, you're absolutely correct. The only way that this is going to make a change is if multitudes of people wake up and realize it's only like this because we put our money there. But if we constantly say, it's going to take time. Don't get me wrong. It's the one person who does it that starts the effect. So we need him, and we need more like him to say, hey, I'll just take my talent here, and I may have to go. We need martyrs. We need people who's going to be like, I may have to struggle so that my children don't. But we don't have many of that now. And I understand it because we live in a world of instant gratification. Mm-hmm. But you have to it's $20,000 and possibly a career going this way instead of just HBCU. There's no money here. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be here because we are the talent.
Right.
And it's like they're going to pay the talent. But until we realize that it's us with the power, it's going to continue to be the way it is. And it's systematic. It's very hard to get out of that. Like, our mindset automatically knows white people are going to have the better, and Black people aren't. And it's and that's with music, sports, books. That's with anything. That's life, and that's what we've been conditioned to. So it sucks, and I refuse once again to go and try and be a part of that world, or to try and fit into that world, because it will never be for me or my kind.
Yeah. And then it's tough for, you know, an 18-year-old kid, and I don't even want to say that comes out of poverty, because that's all the media says when it comes to a Black athlete. Out of poverty, you know, no, I'm not saying that. But any child, period, especially in particular, we're talking about a Black child here, but to have to make that that decision, like, okay, LSU has great facilities, like, top of the line facility, the locker room just got redone. It's like $20 million.
Girl.
Death Valley is like popping and all this. And so,
parties.
Yeah, the parties, everything that comes with being an athlete at LSU. And trust me, I know I have two cousins that went to LSU. One's right now playing football and, you know, he's loving it. So you have this decision to make. Like, okay, am I going to give up that? And sacrifice going to an HBCU. And like Taylor was saying, as much as it's like, man, you know, that'll be great, but just putting yourself in that child's position is like, it's a very...
Oh, no, I completely understand that.
Yeah.
It's a risk. It's a risk. And, and it's one of those things where, and again, this is just what I've heard, y'all. This is not always how I view it. But I have a couple family members who have attended HBCUs. And their biggest criticism is how disorganized HBCUs can be, you know, as far as like getting aid on time, getting registration done. And so very similarly, unfortunately, to like when you go visit a black owned restaurant, you're like, dang, where's the customer service? Dang, where's the food? Why are you always running out of oxtail? You know what I mean? And it's like, I really wish there was some way to remedy that, because I think that kind of turns people off too about HBCUs, is the fear of that I'm going to get lost in translation here.
That's a good point, Taylor. That is a good point.
You know?
But we have to go back to the statistics and show that most of these successful black people in America graduated from an HBCU.
And what I will say about an HBCU is that it teaches you what the real world is like for you.
Right.
Like, it teaches you, like, the successful people make it out of
the whole town.
And it went, going through all those struggles that you mentioned is what makes you realize the truth. Like, to be in that level of comfort, it's to be living in a fantasy. It's to be living in honest, just being something that you're not and will never be accepted for the lifestyle. It's like, it's, and at the time, me living in Cinco Ranch, I'm telling you, like, I was like all for it. I'm trying to go to LSU and I'm going to have white friends and I'm going to be great and I'm going to be rich. Like, I had so many plans, but you learn so much more from going through that struggle.
Yeah.
And you come out on the other end stronger and wiser for what the world really is, not for what they want you to think it is in that box.
Right.
You know, if I could say something, you're saying everything that's like completely correct. Let me say that first of all. It's just like right now I can hear like my parents in my head, because all I keep hearing is them telling me I'm not paying for an experience. You know what I mean? And you're, what you're saying is like an invaluable experience that you can get from HBCU. But to some parents, it's like, what the academics look like though? You know what I mean? Like, I don't care about you having this experience. It's great, but we're not paying for Coachella. Like, we're paying for you to be able to do something with this degree. And I think that's part of the other criticism I've heard. And, you know, some of the PWI, like fellow alumni and stuff like that, that come from different colleges, that's the criticism of the HBCUs. It's like some people, not all, I'm not saying you, Jordan, but like some people choose these places because they're in the pursuit of an experience, right? They're not looking at the college critically. And like, literally, your money is still going here. So it's like, what are you really paying for? Are you paying, you know, for an experience only? Or are you paying because of, you know, other reasons included with this experience?
Right.
But when you're saying it, but see, the experience is what made me who I am. Like, when you're saying experience, I think of experience as I went for, like, drugs or for drinking, for partying, Whereas experience is I'm learning how to be in the world, and I'm going to have a degree on the end. A lot of people try to devalue the degree that you have, but if you're in a specialist field, they can't say anything about your license. That has nothing to do with your degree. So not on top, so on top of that, I'm licensed to do what I need to do, and I learned who I was for this world. So I can get everything I need for my path, and for you can get everything you need for your mind.
No,
your
spirit. I totally agree. But just like, I'm not part of Greek organizations, I'm just going to compare it to, I've heard criticism of people who are part of Greek organizations, where people who want to be a part of that, they are want to be a part for the wrong reasons. We like, you know, they want to stroll and dance, but it's like, this is not what our organization is about. You know what I mean? So my question to you is, have you heard people who are, you know, considering attending an HBCU only talking about the experiences, like the parties and the homecomings and things like that, and not like the educational part?
The education. I believe I've heard that from HBCUs and PWIs.
Facts. Taylor, you went to Texas State. You know
that's
true.
When I was going to college,
I
wasn't going to college because I was trying to get up at my parents' house, regardless of where I went. And that was all my friends around me. I was trying to
That wasn't my motivation.
Yep.
Yeah. It was not. But see, a lot of children by the mind go for that. And see, I'm saying is that where you choose to go, it's going to shape your childish mind into either a childish adult or a mature adult.
Right.
A high school was most definitely not a well-rounded experience for me. It was very one-sided. Mm-hmm. It was a whole nother world that I didn't know about. Mm-hmm. And then coming to a HBCU, I was able to see so many different worlds at one time. And I feel like right. PWIs don't offer you that. PWIs are very strict in what they are. They're going to do they either going to have them cowbells, they're going to have some tigers, they're going to have who they are laid out. Yeah. And it's either you're going to adjust to that lifestyle mm-hmm. or you're not.
And I'm glad that and you I don't, had that experience for sure. Yeah. Like, it was a positive, like, transition for you. Because my brother, my younger brother, he went straight from, you know, KD to HBCU his first year in college, and he completely felt like a fish out of water because all of his education was, you know, in a PWI, and so to go to an HBCU, it was a complete culture shock for him, and he did not do well at all. He did not do well at all.
It's hard. I'm not going to say it was easy.
Yeah.
That transition period, that first year or two, extremely hard because I was so different, and I didn't know I was different. I didn't know I was not Black. I can sit here and be honest with you. I didn't know what being Black was until I got to an HBCU. Mm-hmm. And they could see that. The people there could see that because these people have been Black their whole lives, you know?
Right.
So I'm sitting here looking like a fish out of water, but I acclimated. Mm-hmm. Some people don't, and I can respect that. But I did. But I also had a great foundation. Like, my entire family went to Jackson State. My grandfather taught there. He was a dean there. Mm-hmm. So it's like I had foundation, and I had family to back me up. And I had a mother who took care of all the emotional things that I was going through. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't I was out there trying to fend for myself. I had the family support, too, which is also
who
very important.
Who had already been there before,
It makes a difference. It can be a very terrible experience. I'm not going to say it can't. But I'm saying that if you have the right ingredients and the right motivation and just everything lays, like I'm saying, it's God's plan for some people. And my personal experience was God's plan. I didn't see it starting out, but on the outside, like on the other end, I thank God for the plan. Because I would have went to LSU and been a whole different person that I do not like to see. Like I see pictures of myself in the past, and it's like, wow. My HBCU did that because I was lost, you know? Like, Black people who don't know they're Black are genuinely lost.
Like, I agree.
And it's hard to find. It's hard to find grounding in the world, in America, being Black. It really is.
Right.
But you can find that at an HBCU.
Yeah. One thing I wanted
to... Like Jackson State, if you're listening.
Like Jackson State. Shout out Jackson State. I think, though, Taylor, you were talking about the experience. I think that selling the experience, especially from people who are important, quote-unquote important in our culture, can be a very, very, very great selling point. Because when I saw Beachella for the first time, I was like, I should have went to an HBCU. Because that show was... you know, really about the experience, you know, of going to an HBCU. And so I was, and me, along with millions of other people, were, like, drawn to that because, dang, like, what did we miss out on? Like, all this culture, all this. How did you feel when you watched Beachella, Taylor? Because, you know, we Beyonce fans. But how did you feel you watched it?
I'm going to just start off by saying anything Beyonce touches is gold, okay?
Go.
Okay. I felt amazing watching it. You know, it did give me that sense of like, oh, man, like, I wish I would have experienced this, you know. But I kind of got a cheat code because there was one time that my school played PV, and they bought the baddest band in the land to our football game. And let me tell y'all something. They are no joke. So I had a little sneak peek of experience of that. But it was such a beautiful display. And I honestly, you know, all jokes aside, appreciate the love and the awareness brought to HBCUs because, again, and I'm pretty sure I will end with this type of question, but if I could go back or in my third degree pursuits, I probably will heavily consider pouring that attention to an HBCU for sure.
Right. Yeah, man, me too.
I also would like to say that TV is not the best band in the land. That would be the Sonic Boom of the South. But, okay.
Listen,
I'm telling you, at least the best in Texas.
You know, we got to battle the bands, Prairie View versus TSU.
Okay, you can have that. All right. But regionally, it's Jackson State.
Got it. Period.
I feel that. I'm going to go look up some clips after we get out this call.
She's going to ride hard for us.
Okay.
Yeah. I think people who grew up or didn't grow up in a grounded black household. Like, I know Taylor, like your mom, your dad for sure put you on, you know, game. And obviously, my dad, same thing. So, you know, growing up in our house. Growing up in our house is like, you know, we learned about, you know, our history and all this stuff. So we had identity in a way. But for kids, especially, I've seen this over in Jordan. Taylor, both of y'all. Taylor, you went to Taylor High School. And Jordan went to Cinco with me. And we saw kids that grew up in that environment all their life. Like Jordan lived in Baltimore. She lived in New Orleans, I think. So she had some kind of, you know, her formative years were around people that looked like her. I grew up in Port Arthur. My formative years were people who looked like me. So...
Mm-hmm. I came from A-Lee.
And you grew up in A-Lee. Shout out SWAT. So, but...
Come on, SWAT. Right?
We all saw kids that grew up their whole life in Katy. And they were... It was kind of embarrassing in a way, you know?
They were different.
Yes, very different. Like, they, like...
And I'm sorry to say, that's my brother.
That's my brother! And I just be like, how do I stop this from happening?
Man,
I'm like, do I gotta play Frankie Beverly and Maze more? What do I do? Like,
I know. It's really
I'm
tough.
So scared. My daddy I'm so
look,
scared.
My daddy be so hurt just looking at his only son. Like, why?
My daddy's so supportive.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you see this, huh? And he just be like, man, that's my boy. And I'm like, no, you're supposed to be mad.
That's funny.
Don't worry, I got my boyfriend working on him right now.
Not right now.
I refuse because they just have this weird thing, especially in high school. They just be weird.
Yeah, it's different. Like they're trying to.
I don't want my brother to be associated like that. But that's what I be talking about when black people who don't know they black look lost.
Right.
That's what I talk about.
And for the record, we are not saying black kids who talk intelligently are trying to be white, because that's the thing. Like, if you can articulate yourself, or you got, you know, you're very smart. No, he's trying to be white. No, that's not what we're talking about at all.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
All black people are more so.
Right.
That's period.
Correct. Correct.
Exactly. I don't even like.
Is it again?
No. I was gonna say I don't even like when people try to seem as though the way black people talk in any way isn't articulate, because it's speech regardless.
Right.
It could be accent, but it does not mean that it's not articulate. And I hate when people do that. So sorry.
Same. No, you're fine. Only thing I was gonna ask Kyrie is that my brother is again. It's not about how he talks or even how he dresses. It's a mindset, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the ignorance of the world he lives in, you know, and the fact that the world he lives in doesn't love him, you know, he lives in this little bubble, because he hasn't had it, you know, directly in his face with racism, he doesn't really understand, like, why, you know, I'm so passionate about it, or my mother, or even his grandmother's generation, right? And so I think it's a major disconnect from my brother, from the black experience, you know, in America, and it really... I would hate for him to have a harsh wake-up call to it, but sometimes that's what's needed for you to really get it. You know, it has to be dropped on your court for you to get it, you know?
It'll do it. It'll happen because I wasn't one of those kids that had that problem. But I did have a white best friend through high school, and when these things started happening, sort of like what's happening with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, et cetera, et cetera, you start to see people's true colors eventually. So there will come a time when the people around you disappoint you, because when things start happening and conversations start going on and then you start hearing how people really think. And for us, that was Facebook. So when Trayvon Martin happened, you know, we would be on mm-hmm. Facebook and we would see these people we went to school with that was like, you know, all kiki in our face. And we would see them, their views on these things on Facebook. And it's like, man, you know, another thing I want to talk about before we get off of here is that another thing that is a product of, you know, these kids growing up in these suburban areas, majority of their life, is that they're around girls that are not black. And then they start to see black women as unattractive. That's a real thing.
And they start to see black women as irritating. And I didn't think about
she too loud.
My brother brought it to me because he only is around me and my sister.
Yep.
So he only sees black women as irritating or as bossy or like being as like, you know what I mean? Because these are the only black women he sees.
Right.
And all the white girls probably look soft and innocent.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like, and then we get mad when they want to be with a white girl.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, my brother similarly, raised in a single at home with just me and my mom. You know, we're some heavy hitters. You know what I mean? We are some very, very, you know,
you have to
big personality.
As a black
you
woman.
Know? And mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's I wouldn't say that he doesn't, you know, find black women attractive, but he does have a very open spectrum of women that he finds attractive.
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely not like, you know, like how my fiance, you know, I've always, he's at 20. So, he's
20?
A little, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Girl, yeah. My brother's 13. So I'm thinking we were relating. Girl,
no,
he's grown.
Like, stop it now. Stop it now.
No, that's him, okay. Baby. The ship sailed.
But I don't know. I'm looking at more.
Thank God.
I'm more exposure to different types of black women other than his annoying mom and sister, as you were saying.
We gotta get out, but we live in a socially isolating society.
Yep. The world is still, America is still very segregated. Even more segregated than it was in the 60s in some ways.
And we're even more isolated now.
Right, that's what I was saying.
Which is scary. Like, we don't even talk to people the way we used to. We don't go out. We meet online, you know?
Yep. It's crazy.
This generation's not even communicating. Like, that's the disconnect because they don't communicate how we communicate. Like, conversations are foreign for them.
Right. I was just thinking about that the other day. I was like, man, we had to go, you know, get on a bike and go to our friend's house, see if they were home. And now they can just, you know, text. Like,
see if they were
home.
You
want to come outside?
Or no, you want to get on the game.
Yeah, you want to get
on the
game.
Online. They don't even go outside, Kyrie.
At all.
My dad did a whole basketball court in the backyard for no one.
For me. For me and Al. That's what he built it for, really.
The next Kobe where?
Right? Kobe was outside.
Kobe would be outside. Yeah. They don't go outside. It's scary. It's terrifying. It almost makes you not want to have... Well, this is me personally, and this isn't even about HBCUs anymore, and I'm sorry, but, like, do y'all ever have fear about having children? Because I don't know what the next 10 years are going to look like for them, or the next 15 or the next 20.
I thought about that all the time, and I'm a person who wants kids. Like, that's my thing. Like, I want a lot of kids. Mm-hmm. And even me, I have those thoughts. I'm like, man, do I really want to bring a child into this? Because it looks like it's getting worse and worse.
Do I want to?
You know?
Yeah.
Because this is really, it's getting bad.
Yeah.
I go through that too. I go through that thought. For me, it's really close because I get married this Saturday. Woohoo! And so we definitely have, you know, talk about kids and discuss that. But, you know, for me, it's not a crippling fear. I will say it's more so a concern. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I just always think back to, like, my grandmother's generation where they were birthing kids during Jim Crow, you know what I mean? So I'm like, we're not there. Of course, we still got a lot of work to do, but we're not, like, there, you know? So I'm like, if they could brave it and still give birth and look how, you know, much we've done and look how many beautiful people have come from, you know, their fearlessness and them just trusting God, you know, to lead them in child-rearing. I'm just putting my faith in God, you know? I'm not going to let fear cripple me, but it is a very valid concern. For sure. I may not have a bunch of kids, but I definitely want to pass on, you know, this bossness to the next generation.
So, in conclusion, thank you, Taylor and Jordan, for coming on. Y'all did great. In conclusion, I want to say that Thurgood Marshall graduated from an HBCU, and Barack Obama graduated from a PWI. So that is two successful Black leaders in American history, mm-hmm. and they both graduated from two different institutions. So guys, mm-hmm. we can dominate anywhere we go. Thank you, Jordan. Thank you, Taylor. Thank you, audience. That is it for episode 57 of the All That Podcast.